Hello and welcome to Nintendo World Report's Connectivity, episode 329. I'm your host, Neil Ronahan. Joining me today is John Raritan.
Howdy.
And Alex DeFrantis.
What's up?
And we are excited to talk about the brand new Nintendo console. Did you guys hear the rumors that the Switch Pro is finally here?
It's about damn time.
It is a Splatoon 3 Switch OLED model.
Yes, a Switch Pro Sploon Edition.
The Pro is you while you're playing Splatoon.
It was a very funny turn of events. This will be aged slightly, but the night before we're recording this, there was a lot of like empty calorie rumor banter about how like Nintendo is going to unveil a new console. It's going to be the Switch Pro finally. And then Nintendo was just like, yeah, we're doing a limited variant of the OLED for Splatoon 3. Honestly, system looks cool. I think I might try to get that Pro Controller. I need a new Pro Controller. That one looks nice. I think as we talked about before the show, I think the D-pads are improved on the newer ones. So hopefully I'll get a newer D-pad on a Pro Controller and have a second one after living life as a one Pro Controller heathen.
The wait for the Pro continues.
Yeah.
Yep. They're probably saving it for... It's the Pro is going to come bundled with Metroid Prime Remake and the GoldenEye Remake.
Yeah.
Yep. The Switch Pro is the enhanced D-pad on the new Switch Pro controller. That's yes. It. That's the big upgrade we were all waiting for.
Honestly,
in fact, after you saying that is what I'm probably like, I'm going to look it up and see when it's coming out. So
if they released an OLED model that was just the OLED model, but the left Joy-Con had a fucking D-pad on it, then I'd be like, yeah, that's like, yeah, you can keep your 4K DLSS. Like, I just want a D-pad.
I did like the goalpost got moved for the rumor. And it's not even like the existence of there being like the 4K DLSS, you know, like Switch model probably made more like Switch OLED is kind of more of an enhanced Switch Lite. If you think about it, it is like the new 2DS XL to the 2DS.
I mean, it can still dock, so I'd say it's a new 3DS.
It can
3DS.
Still dock, but, yeah.
Or not even a new, it's just a 3DS XL.
Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing where it's the OLED does not do anything to the TV experience.
Oh, outside I see of, I guess, what you're
like,
saying.
Like yeah. Hardwired internet. Like, that's the only thing, I guess, it technically does. And, like, there is the new dock and everything. But as far as the hardware itself, when you're playing on a TV, it functions, as far as I can tell, virtually identically to your normal dockable Switch.
Yeah.
That's what I largely mean by the fact that the OLED is kind of more a successor to the Lite than it is a successor to the OG in through a certain point of view.
Yes. No, that makes sense. I understand what you're saying.
Is there a Digital Foundry video I can watch about the different docks and just see
what percentage they did cover the OLED.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any difference between the. I mean, like I said, it like form wise, they're different, of course.
Oh yeah, internally they're identical.
Yeah,
They just built in the USB adapter for the LAN port into the dock.
No, I mean, I would not be surprised by like a Switch Pro that is basically an enhanced TV version of the Switch coming at some point in the next year or two or whatever. But it is just funny to see people being like, "It's coming tomorrow."
Which
I mean, like, shit, man, who knows, maybe
I'm just scared of anybody trying to release another piece of hardware right now. Like, because it's
not great,
it's not good out there right now for supply chains and such, chip shortages and whatnot.
But there was apparently some rumor person who claimed that they like, I called the Splatoon model, there's another one coming. And it's like immediately after that, it's like, you know, there's a Pokemon game coming out. Like every mainline Pokemon game gets a mod.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, these are not hard guesses to make.
Yeah. Even I mean, like, I would not be surprised, but like a Switch Lite that has the Scarlet and Violet, like legendary Pokemon on the back or whatever.
And at the risk of like saying that there's a pattern, because, you know, there really isn't. But these games or these hardware refreshes usually come out within 2 years of each other. They usually give. There's a little bit of a gap between, you know, and like, how would fans react if there was a new Switch Pro if the OLED just came out last year?
How are Switch systems selling?
Pretty good.
Well,
yeah, it'd be fine. people would probably be a little mad. I don't think it would really harm sales.
And I think as long as there's a substantial difference, I don't know. I feel like the people who bought the OLED are either people who hadn't bought a Switch yet and were just going to buy one either, or they're like, the, you know, someone who's maybe a little bit more into like the tech end of stuff and really likes the screen, but like they understand what they're buying. Like,
yeah,
the OLED is for all intents and purposes just the base Switch now. Like, I don't even know if they're actively, are they actively producing the original model anymore?
I don't know.
Or is it just what's left on the shelf?
Yeah, it might be.
Like the there, it's not really like there's the Switch and then the OLED is the enhanced Switch. The OLED is just the Switch now.
Yeah.
Like that's it. So if something new came out, I kind of feel like that's still, you would still have the OLED as your Switch and the Switch Pro 4K, whatever the hell, as your enhanced model.
Yeah, it might be more like the GBASP brighter screen, or like the brighter screen edition is just the new one.
Yep.
It replaced the old one.
I mean, I would also say to a certain extent with the patterns, which I think if you do look back at like the DS and 2DS, like there is a pretty consistent like year and a half to 2 year cadence with a lot of those revisions. I think the 3DS it started to get condensed, but that usually does. I mean, with handhelds, it's a little bit different, or at least pure handhelds, it's a little bit different. But I like the pandemic probably threw off any, like if they were like, we're going to do it every 2 years, that might have. But I mean, they kind of did do it every 2 years. So who knows? I mean, but that's also the kind of thing that, like, let's say in a world where the pandemic doesn't happen, wouldn't that be nice? You have your launch Switch in March 2017. You have the light in, that was September 2019. I mean, maybe without that, maybe the OLED's in early 21, and whatever the Pro could have been holiday 2022, and then that's a year and a half gap and not as ridiculous.
And that's assuming the OLED even exists without the pan. Like, the OLED may very well be that plan may not have existed before the pandemic.
There was that Bloomberg report where I think like Nintendo just like came into a really good deal on OLED screens.
Yeah, that was the only reason that like we knew something was happening was it was like, okay, we have receipts for them buying these. Like, they are doing
something. They have
something
to go on something.
Right.
Game and watches.
I mean, those would be some nice Game and watches.
Yeah.
I want Game and Watch on NSO so bad. I want that to, instead of like Game Boy, or like everybody can be hyped for GameCube and then they just put Game and Watch on there. Trickle the
just
games
like
out.
It's just like typing out G A M E C backspace and watch.
Yeah, that'd be beautiful.
But yeah, so that's Splatoon 3 is getting an OLED. How are you guys? Let's take the temperature. Once again, we are now 2 months away from Splatoon 3. How are you guys feeling about Splatoon 3? Any changes in your temperature?
Nope. They need to show me a substantial single player that's not.
It is a game that is coming out.
Yep. In September. Right now it looks a whole lot like Splatoon 2 to me, and I don't see why I would buy it.
I am more interested in the direct or the video that they drop explaining the game rather than the game itself at this moment.
I agree with that. Like, the single player really is going to hinge on whether or not I'm excited for it. I think we've talked about it before on the show where, like, I'm going to get this game. I'll play it. It just depends on, will I play it feverishly or like play it with. It feels like the equivalent of like I'm doing my taxes on my Switch, where like I have to do this because like it's going to be a nice community thing, and like we're all going to play Splatoon, maybe do a Splatfest or two, maybe try to schedule some Salmon Runs.
Salmon Run would be incredible.
I love Salmon Run so much. That's the one that's actually people kind of gave them crap for when like that. I think that was in the direct when they were like showing off Salmon Run. I'm like, what? I'm glad it's back. Like that was a killer mode.
No, for real. Whenever I go back to Splatoon, that's what I play. Like, I feel a little too out of the loop to play the regular competitive multiplayer. I play Salmon Run.
I will say, when they showed Salmon Run, though, I did have a moment of going, like, I'm honestly not sure if this is a new map or not. Like, you could have made it look slightly different. Like, it just looks like the same map. And, like, maybe
again,
it isn't.
Like, you
don't
need to reinvent the wheel with it. It's, but yeah, it is, but you like, there's a lot that you could that you right. need to do. To...
You could have made it like noon or like nighttime yeah. as opposed to sunset. Like there are little things you could do to make it like not look like literally the exact like you could show me footage and I wouldn't be able to tell you if it's Splatoon 3 Salmon Run or Splatoon 2 Salmon Run. And that's a problem, I think. There's nothing that separates this game from its predecessor from just like the consumer standpoint, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Well, speaking of games that we want to look at and find differences between their previous game on Switch, John, you have been playing Xenoblade 3 on Nintendo Switch.
It's been a secret.
How have you been enjoying the Xenoblade 3?
I have really enjoyed the first chapter and a half that I'm allowed to talk about. and I am ambivalent towards the rest of the game that I'm not allowed to talk about.
Good.
I have the embargo is open on my monitor right now, and we are going to be careful.
So John is playing through Xenoblade 3 for review, and there was a preview embargo that went up pretty much almost alongside this podcast going live.
It'll have been yesterday.
Okay.
When you're listening to this.
But I've definitely, like, as we've talked about it on the show before, I'm not the biggest Xenoblade 2 fan, but what I've seen of Xenoblade 3 and what I've heard from you about the first chapter and a half has been pretty encouraging. Are the tutorials, they're in chapter one, right?
They are, and I think I told you about this already, but one of the first things the tutorials teach you is how to replay the tutorials. And I was brilliant. Like, oh, Neil's going to be so excited.
I'm so happy. It's nice because through that and the direct, it does seem evident that Monolith Soft, you know, there was a lot of acclaim around Xenoblade 2. A lot of people love that game from you, from other people. Yes. There were also people like me who sticks in the mud, who did not enjoy the game as much. But it seems like
I'm a stick in the mud. That's me.
Yeah. Join the stick in the mud party. But it seems like Monolith Soft is actually like, OK, you know, there are some things we can prove about that. Let's try to fix them up.
Yeah, I think the general perception around 2, like I still like 2 a lot. I don't remember what I gave it. But I
feel like an 8.5.
I think it might have been a 9. I don't remember.
We can find this out.
We do have the technology. I might have given it a 9.5. I don't think I gave it a 9.5.
I don't think you went 9.5. Let's see.
9.5.
All right, 9.5. Okay, so in retrospect,
I critique this game a lot. I talked in 1.5 point.
I probably wouldn't have gone, or I probably wouldn't go 9.5 now. But a lot of that is honestly just because the things that I had issues with, it was really hard to tell when you're in review isolation if those are actually an issue if you're not playing the game at a breakneck speed to get it done by embargo. Like all of like the weird field skill gates where you had to have stuff leveled up to a certain amount before you could pass through there. I kind of had the thought of like, oh, if I'm just playing this for fun, all that stuff would probably already be leveled up because I'd be doing side quests and things. Turns out, nope. But I will say the first chapter and a half of this game, I think it's felt like one of the easiest first chapters and a half. But not because it's actually any less difficult, but because all of that kind of stuff isn't there. Like, it feels a bit more like Xenoblade 1 in that respect, where there's no field skill gates, there's no random gacha mechanics. There's less going into an area and being like, all right, what dumb thing am I have to gonna do to get through this area? what random asinine puzzle in very large quotation marks am I gonna have to do? Like, it's just, you're gonna level up, you're gonna, you know, find classes that you like, and you're gonna upgrade things, and like, that's it. And it's just very straightforward, which feels a bit more classic.
Sounds great. Like, legitimately, like, yeah, hearing what you have in your preview, the video preview that you should go watch, I'm getting really excited to play this game.
It'll be interesting to see. I think the people who, because there are kind of two camps, I guess there are three camps, maybe there's four if you count Xenoblade X, but nobody ever does. They're the people who really like Xenoblade 1. There's some people who really like Xenoblade 2. And those camps kind of tend to butt heads just because those games do feel pretty different. And then there are the people like me who like both of them. I am curious to see how the more Xenoblade 2 focused fans are going to react to this game. Because I think it kind of like a lot of the interface looks like Xenoblade 2 on the surface, but deep down, I think it's much more Xenoblade 1.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm very interested to see what the reaction is.
Kind of what excites me. But you also do got to think that, I mean, Xenoblade 2 is the best seller in the series, and also like the first one on the system, which is likely where a lot of the audience for 3 is going to come from.
Well, and it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard to tell. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, yes, it's the best seller. So, yes, theoretically, the most people played. Though, is that combining all of the releases of Xenoblade 1? Because it has been released 4 times, if we count the virtual console.
Well, I mean, the new 3DS barely sold enough.
I bought one.
I would be curious. Because I know like Xenoblade 2 was the bestseller when it came out. It might depend on how well Definitive Edition did.
And that I don't know. Because that's the thing. I think
Definitive Edition did okay, but it definitely didn't like do a ton.
I think also one has to keep in mind that for the case of Xenoblade 2, it's arguably the first time that they made enough copies.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Xenoblade X, I think, was one of the best-selling Wii U games.
Reggie allowed that one to exist.
He did.
Yeah.
He graced it. But, like, Xenoblade 1 sold out on Wii and then sold out on 3DS. Like, that, it's hard to gauge, like, okay, would it have sold more if there were copies for people to buy? Because that game was notoriously hard to find on both platforms. The Definitive Edition was the first time that anybody could actually buy the original.
Okay, Definitive Xenoblade Chronicles 1 has definitely outsold. This is official Nintendo numbers. Is Xenoblade Chronicles 2 is at 2.17. I don't know exactly when this is as of. And Definitive Edition is at 1.5 million.
Okay, so combined.
And then I think the numbers on VG Sales Wiki, I think, are sourced from VG Charts, because as we learned in our F-Zero GX research, that I think that all that happened offline. But when people were like, F-Zero sold very well, Nagoshi said that GX sold 1.5 million. It did not sell 1.5 million because Nintendo... Basically, every million seller on a Nintendo console, we know. Sometimes the exact numbers of things under a million, we don't know.
But if it crosses that threshold, we know. Yep.
So Xenoblade Chronicles did not cross that threshold on Wii or new 3DS. But even like I don't trust the VG charts numbers that are cited here. But I would imagine that. You know, what is there? There's a little over 500,000 gap between 2 and Definitive Edition. I would imagine that the Wii version of Xenoblade and the 3D, the new 3DS version, which sold like poop, they probably total enough to make Xenoblade Chronicles the highest selling entry in the franchise, even if it's split across 3, technically 4 releases, because it was on Virtual Console.
Yeah, you're not even factoring those in. I'm sure those sales were very high. I've been told that everything on Virtual Console sold really well as well by random people on Twitter.
The 24 sales that caused the Xenoblade Chronicles to be the top seller on the entire Wii U eShop for a month. And then X didn't cross a million, which is a tragedy.
But it did, like, in the context of a Wii U game, it did well.
I mean, there's a reason why they weren't like, kill Xenoblade Chronicles after X. But I mean, Nintendo is a smart enough company to know that you don't kill Xenoblade and Paper Mario and even Mario Tennis.
As you pointed out in the last episode, you don't kill Xenoblade because they're literally just developing tech for your Zelda games. Yep. You might as well let them put a game out with with their tech demo that they've been making for Zelda.
It's a good sneak peek into what's going to show up next.
Oh, yeah, no, there is the line from Xenoblade X to Breath of the Wild to Xenoblade 2 to Breath of the Wild 2 is very clear to see, even just from trailers. It is it is not a mystery.
But so yeah. Xenoblade 3.
Xenoblade 3.
So anything else to add about Xenoblade 3 before we move on?
We need to talk about classes. That's my question.
Oh, okay, you want to know about classes.
What's your question about classes?
I tell me about them. I want to know how they interact. How do you like level them up separately from like your character level? So, do they mix and match well?
Because this is basically the first game with any kind of like separate class system, right?
Yeah. So I would say the classes essentially replace blades. From Xenoblade 2. So they have a similar mechanic in that's how you change weapons.
You can switch classes kind of like you switch blades.
You can't do it on the fly, but so as you rank up a class, and like ranking it up gets your stats better, and like improves like the moves that you have. Once you get it to rank 10, then and like that means you've mastered the class, then one of the skills or the arts from that class will then become accessible to any of your classes. So if you use like a medic class and level that up to 10, you'll be able to bring one of those skills over then to your tank class or your swordsman class. Carry with you up to 3 extra skills from other classes. So I mean, I keep saying skills, but I mean arts, like moves from extra classes. Yeah. And so it gives you like, yeah, you can kind of look at like, okay, this character, like I want them to be an attacker. Cause the three, like every class, there's each character. And this goes for your party member and the hero characters that you encounter. Cause you can learn their classes too. Each character has their own class. There's no overlap in actual classes. Every single character has a unique class with a unique moveset. But then each one of those classes is organized into either attacker, tank, or healer. And so you can kind of say, you know, I want Noah, the main character, to be an attacker, which is kind of what he generally works best as. But I'm also going to cross-train him a bunch of these healer classes so I can get some healer moves to have as a bonus on his normal attack.
So he can be like an off-healer to kind of help support the other healer.
Yeah. So it just it gives you a lot of freedom of creativity. Or, you know, you could say like with my healers, I put all my healers cross training as other healers, which essentially just meant that they had their normal healer moves and then they had 3 extra other healer moves, which just, you know, essentially as arts are recharging, they just constantly have access to things that can heal and just makes them a way more efficient healer. So there's a lot of freedom to kind of customize on how exactly you set things up,
how are the healers really different from each other? Is like one of them like a heal over time, one's like a
like the first, the healers that you have access to that I can talk about in the first chapter and a half, one of them is like a very direct, you know, she does a move and it has an area of effect that heals when it hits. And then the other healer he's technically a healer, but a lot of his stuff is more like buffs. And so he'll drop like, when you use buffs, it'll drop like a ring on the ground and anyone inside that ring gets that buff and that ring is active for a certain amount of time. So he may drop a ring that increases your armor. And anybody who's standing in that ring gets that buff.
Okay. So it does sound like positioning is very important.
Yes, and that's true of every Xenoblade. Like, that's what makes the combat interesting, is, like, while it, on the surface, looks like World of Warcraft, where you're just, like, auto-attacking and then throwing in arts, where you're positioned relative to enemies and relative to your party is super important. And you can also, like...
simple enough? It's like, there's 7 characters on your party, right? Like,
it's a chaotic nightmare.
Okay.
And it's beautiful.
Okay.
And yes, they do all scream in British accents the entire time.
That's awesome.
It's great.
That's what I want.
But yeah, so even within a single like type, each class is still very different. Like every tank feels very different. Every attacker feels very different. And I've definitely found that I have favorites. And there are some where like I already have this already ranked up all the way. I don't like, so it's technically better for me to go do another class, but I might go to this one if I'm having trouble because that's my favorite class to use and I like the moveset for it. So you'll definitely develop favorites from the classes.
Yeah, Bravely Default, my favorite thing about that those games and matching the different class skills so that they synergize super well. So you can get like a couple skills from a Berserker class while you're playing as a Red Mage, and like somehow those two things work together super well. So
a lot of different games, like Octopath did that very well too.
This feels like a very good way. One of the things I didn't like as much about Xenoblade 2 was that at any given time you only have access to three arts, because you just have like three of your face buttons dedicated to that, and then your other, like your D-pad, is dedicated to switching blades, but all those have a cooldown, so like going between a bunch of different arts isn't actually realistic. And this system allows you to always have access to six, which feels a lot more, it's not quite the monstrosity that Xenoblade and Xenoblade X were with that giant bar of arts along the bottom of the screen. But it feels a bit closer to that, giving you a lot more options for what you can do.
So, Alex, as we sit here recording this episode, I hope that Bandai Namco will actually address the fact that a Klonoa game is coming out outside of Japan. Hope Springs Eternal. It got mentioned in a direct that feels ages ago. And since then, it feels like Bandai Namco is ignoring that they are releasing a Klonoa game outside of Japan.
It still says coming soon on the eShop, within, you know, 2 days of it coming out, supposedly.
It's not even on the eShop.
Oh, God.
There is a placeholder page.
Yeah.
If you go on the website. Okay. I don't know if it's on the store.
No, on the physical. I recorded, I actually checked to see if it was. It is not there.
Okay, so it's just a placeholder site on the website then.
It's probably from the direct.
I guess for anybody who doesn't know how the eShop kind of works on the back end, once something shows up with a store page, like on your actual Switch, that generally means that like the game is there.
Yeah. If a game is pre-orderable, that means the game is there.
Yeah. It may not be like the final version of the game, but like something is there.
And Nintendo can usually do timey-wimey stuff because they're the platform holder. Because you'll see that when it's like, Pokemon, available for pre-order right now, and we're still 4 months out.
Yeah, that's also an interest. Like, that can also, you can also kind of look at that and say, like, oh, this Sonic Frontiers, it's the day before it comes out, and it doesn't have a store page yet. That probably means that nobody's reviewing it.
Yep.
Because or at least review codes also can't go out until there's a game on the shop. So,
I think there's. I have witnessed very rare times where Switch review codes have gone out while there hasn't been a visible store page.
Oh, really? I don't think I've ever seen that.
I guess, and I think we can even talk about Axiom Verge 2, because that was a shadow drop for Indie World. We got Switch code for that beforehand.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how they did it.
Yeah.
But considering that the dude doing PR for that, like, used to work at Nintendo, maybe he's like, I know where the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
Let me do this now.
And you'll notice how when we got that, we didn't then leak the embargo email on that and say that there would be a Nintendo Direct.
No, like, we just shut the fuck up about it.
Yeah, we just did our jobs.
We were like, yes, we will cover the game. And guess what? Axiom Verge 2 fucking slaps.
Yeah.
I love that game. Been meaning to replay it because I think I like it more than the first one. But regardless, Klonoa, there are two games that are going to be in the Fantasy Reverie release.
Fantasy Reverie series. Spelled with a P-H.
As you would.
Like Phantasy Star?
Like Phantomile. Because it's Door to Phantomile. That's the name of the first game. But yes, also like Phantasy Star, since you asked. Yeah, those games are coming out. Supposedly, allegedly, they're coming out. I did a preview on them about a week ago now.
There was a Japanese demo.
That wasn't released in North America for whatever reason. It
hasn't been released outside of Japan.
Oh, I didn't even realize that demo was Japan only.
Yeah. It's Japan only.
That's great.
It is honestly frustrating how little they are promoting this game outside of Japan. But it does exist, and I'm very excited for it.
Did the demo was in English, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Crazy bastards.
Well, I opened the demo with my North American account and it worked just fine. It presented in English.
Yeah, I just, the fact that, like, even for the demo version, they included the English localization in that demo.
Yeah.
I'd be curious if the... I mean, there's also the thing with, I guess, more eShop behind the scenes. Some Japanese games have universal ROMs that will then... Yeah. Like, work with everything. Like, I think Splatoon 2 is an example of a game that does not have a universal ROM. Like, I think if you buy the Japanese version of the Splatoon 2, I think you might be able to only play that on a Japanese account. It's very rare that games don't have universal ROMs.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I mean, it might not be. It means they're. It's the same game and you can play it on any region account. And that seems to be the case with Klonoa.
Yep. And so it plays well. It looks decent. I know, Neil, you don't really care for the updated graphics.
I feel like so I played the remake of the first one back on Wii, and thought it looked great on Wii. And I feel like the retouch of the remake that's on Switch doesn't look quite as good. I do think Klonoa 2, the PS2 game that is also included, Door to Lunetea's Vale is the subtitle, I think.
It's just Lunetea's Vale,
Just the Lunetea's Vale. Yeah, it's Door to Phantom Isle, Lunetea's Vale. I think that looks a lot
better.
How do
you get there without a door?
I don't know. I mean, you get there at the end. We need to play the first game to find out what happens.
You need the key from Kingdom Hearts, the Keyblade.
Yeah.
That's how
for
you get
a door?
There. Yep.
Is there a door or isn't there?
I don't want to spoil anything.
Okay. Is that
like
a spoiler?
Weirdly, you look at like Klonoa and you're like adorable 2D platformer. There's legitimately story beats that I don't want to spoil.
Yeah.
That, I have heard that from a lot of people. Yeah.
Like you're like, this is some Kirby stuff. Like, no, like there is things that happen, man.
Yeah, it'll change you. Like, pay attention to what the story tries to tell you in the prologue. Because it's not just fluff like I thought it was. But yeah, so you think Lunetea's Vale looks pretty good in the remake? Yeah. I say I like the remake. That's the way I played it first, but it is a little Smash Brothers Brawl-y where it's kind of like, oh, it's a little gray compared to the original. And I think I appreciate Fantasy Reverie series for trying to bring it back to the PS1's more saturated colorful look despite like using literally the exact same geometry and basis from the Wiimake, but it's definitely not like a looker, you know. It is a budget remaster of these games.
It is the developer is the same people who developed the Katamari Damacy reroll from Bandai Namco, which is a totally serviceable, you know, port remake of the first Katamari Damacy.
They also did what's those like Genesis games? The Monster Boy? Wonder Boy?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what they're called. I think they did like the fourth one, the one with like the female protagonist. It's okay. Like what I'm excited about is that these games are being reintroduced, and especially Klonoa 2 is coming back. What's going to be interesting is me like having written a preview and then having to write the review. I kind of sat there for a moment writing the preview, like, how am I going to avoid like sounding like I'm going to say the exact same thing, because there's not a whole lot new to say about games that are just like, this is a pretty decent package of these two games we've had before. I'll probably have a lot more to say about Klonoa 2 since that's a game that's going to be new to me. But
it's also going to be new to a lot of people because the only release of that was the PS2 version,
right? Yes, exactly. Yeah, there was supposedly a reported, not officially announced, but reported by a magazine, a remaster or port for GameCube of that game, but that got scrapped. But the way I got around writing the preview was actually I just aped what Neil did for Kirby. I just, instead of writing like a straight up here's several paragraphs of what I think, I did bullet points. I think that worked out pretty well for me.
Yeah, previews are hard to write.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely fall into the trap of just sort of like I write like almost a review, but then I don't score it and I'm not very critical. Like, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's something that it's almost like a bygone art, just in the nature of I feel like even event coverage is usually covered more in discussion than it is formal written, like, here's my hands-on preview of something I played on a show floor.
Yeah.
That still happens, but I feel like coverage has kind of evolved. Like that. I mean, it's something that, like, I always kind of enjoyed that challenge, because especially at something as chaotic as like an E3, like, you might not get that ideal perfect way to play it. You might not have that person, that booth attendant, you know, walking you through everything delicately. It might be a little chaotic. It might be, you know, you might get to explore more because someone's not paying attention. You might have a bad time because something wasn't explained. I always go back to the story of playing the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Smash Brothers game that came out on Wii, where the booth attendant there just mercilessly kicked the crap out of me and Zach Miller without explaining us how to play the game. It's a unique perspective of covering games, because it's not, you know, it's not a finished product. It's not a final thought. It's kind of like, this is the snapshot of me playing this game in this moment.
So the juiciest bit of info that we can talk about with Klonoa is a recent interview done with the producer, I believe. Neil, you might need to back me up.
I do not know the exact name of the producer off the top of my head, because there's a chain of telephone game of telephone that happened. I think it was like something reported from a magazine that then got sifted through, or a Japanese magazine that it got sifted through translators and stuff. But anyway, someone involved with the Klonoa game coming out on Switch made a comment when asked a question that I don't think is known exactly what it was to most people, but said something along the lines of, if you want to see more Klonoa games, like, hey, buy this one and hopefully we'll be able to remake more or make new ones. And it annoyed me because, I mean, not the quote from the producer, because, like, what's that dude going to say? Like, if someone's like, hey, like, do you think we should make more? And he'd be like, well, you need to buy this one first. That's what you're interviewing me about, is this video game.
Mm-hmm.
And it always gets to the thing of like, oh, like, why do companies do this? Why do they hold games hostage by just giving us remakes? And in the case of Klonoa, it's rich to me, because Klonoa is a series that was always kind of more cult classic than anything else. It did get a surprising amount of games. I would imagine that the original game probably sold well enough to be able to spawn a sequel, a bunch of Game Boy games, stuff like that.
There's a volleyball spinoff.
Yeah, yeah.
On PlayStation 1.
There was a PS1 for that one?
Yes. The Klonoa Volleyball came out in Europe and Japan after Klonoa 2, Lunatea's Veil, came out on PS2. It's a funny little tidbit.
Weird. Oh, wow. Yeah. I knew there's a Dream Champ tournament is the one that's on are the Dream Champ tournament that is just a straight up
platformer? Yeah. Okay. No, you might be thinking of Klonoa Heroes. Is a like action RPG, top down action RPG for the Game Boy Advance. Recently got a pretty in-depth fan translation, actually, that never came out in the West.
Yeah, so I mean, it had a nice run in the fact that, you know, there was some PlayStation games and it branched out a little bit and then kind of faded away. But then there was the Wii remake of the first game that came out in 2008. That's actually the first time I ever encountered the series, and I thought that game was fantastic. Apparently, not many other people did, because I think there were at least rumored, I don't know if it was officially announced, but they were going to do Klonoa 2 in a similar remake style as Klonoa on Wii. And then that did not happen because sales of Klonoa 1 on Wii weren't great. And that's the kind of thing where it's like, hey, like, if you want to see more of a thing, maybe you have to buy the thing. Right. Not saying that, like, it's, you know, I'm not here to strong arm people who maybe you played Klonoa 1 on Wii and were like, oh, I enjoyed that. And you see this and you're like, well, I don't feel like playing Klonoa 1 again. I mean, Klonoa 2 is there. Go check it out. That's honestly, I have a feeling I might play through Klonoa 1. And if I get to a point where I'm like, I kind of just want to play the game I haven't played before, I might just kick over to Klonoa 2.
Yeah.
But like, it is at a certain point, like when you do have remakes and ports, like it's not like buy what you want to buy, but also don't be mad if a company's like, hey, if this port or remake doesn't sell well, we're probably not going to do anything more with this series, because there's a financial investment involved with making a brand new Klonoa game that Bandai Namco is probably looking at, like, we can make some more anime games instead and make a lot more money that way, have a way better profit margin than, like, you know, reviving this niche franchise that people didn't show up for when we tried to bring it back 10 years ago.
It's
15.
It's,
oh my God. 14 years ago. Jesus. Right.
It's the same thing as F-Zero and stuff like that you see constantly from Nintendo fans where they want this stuff back. And it's like, yeah, it'd be great, but it never did that well in the first place. Like, Nintendo is here to make money, not to make a game specifically for you.
Yeah, and I get that it's upsetting to, like, fans who see the response just be, well, if people buy this game, and then especially me, like, sitting here thinking, but you're not promoting this game out in the West. It's not going to do well. I can already see what's going to happen here. It's not going to be good for the franchise. But there's a perfectly logical A to B where, like, a reporter who's going to talk about this franchise coming back and getting revival with a remaster collection, they're obviously going to want to ask about what's next for the series. And the producer is obviously going to respond, well, if this does well commercially, then we can do more. Like, if I was in the position to talk to people at WayForward about Advance Wars Reboot Camp, I would be asking the exact same question, and I'm sure I'd get the exact same answer of, like, oh, yeah, we'd love to do more, but, you know, this one has to sell well.
It has to come out.
Yeah, that's you.
I wanted to double check. So I found the interview. This is from Hideo Yoshizawa, who was the creator of the original. Also worked on the Ninja Gaiden NES games. Love him. So this interview question, I'm just going to read his entire quote here. The question asked, there was an attempt to resurrect Klonoa with a Wii remake of the original game. Do you think you'll revisit Klonoa again anytime in the future? Here's what Yoshizawa said. This was an interview from 4 or 5 years ago. Personally, I'd like to make one, but I don't know how Bandai Namco feels about that. When Bandai and Namco merged, the vice president from Bandai at the time was a huge Klonoa fan, and he basically spearheaded the remake. We originally wanted to make an all-new Wii Klonoa, but our supervisor from the Bandai side said that would be too expensive. We ended up formulating a business plan. We'd, quote, test the waters with a remake of the first game, and if that did well, we'd port the second game. Then we'd move on to an all-new installment. If the remake sold well, we'd move ahead with the development of the third game and pump out the port in the meantime. Unfortunately, the remake didn't sell well, so it all got scrapped.
It's fascinating that, like, because that remake, like, he talks about that as, you know, being the cheap option. That remake, even if it's not the prettiest in the world, is a complete remake. Like, it overhauls every visual element of, like, there is nothing carried over from the PS1 game. I'm surprised they didn't start by porting the second one, to be honest. Like, that would, going from PS2 to Wii, you could,
that would have been an easier job.
Well, I mean, I think that's when they said if the first one did well, they'd pump out the port in the meantime while they worked on the third game, probably because PS2 to Wii would have been a pretty clean transition.
Yeah, I'm just surprised they didn't start, because that would have been, you know, as far as, like, lowest cost of entry, surely porting the PS2 onto the Wii would be cheaper than essentially, that remake is essentially making a brand new game.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a cool quote, though, like, because it's very earnest with exactly what the plan was. Like,
yeah, it's very cool transparent
insight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, like, I do like that quote, and it sucks. And it is the kind of thing where I'd, I do not. I'm 99% sure that he is not involved with this new collection. He was involved with the remake back in 2008. But it's still, it sucks to see that kind of stuff happen. And you see it a lot more with a lot of Japanese developers where they don't realize that people actually like the games that they made. Like, I was struck by, I kind of want to see if I can find this quote for Chrono Cross when it came out, they sent over like an interview, like some interview quotes from.
Oh, yeah, I remember this.
I can't find it that easily, but it was, I'll paraphrase what, oh my God, Masato Kato, the director of Chrono Cross, said. Was people, like, the question was along the lines of, like, how does it feel to have such a beloved classic come back? And he's like, y'all liked it? Like, yeah. Everybody, like, I just remember everybody telling me that I ruined Chrono Trigger. And it is the kind of thing where, I mean, like, that's like, I earnestly think Masato Kato is one of, like, the one of the pioneers of narratives in video games. I mean, so is Yoshizawa. There's a feature that I think I teased writing back when Chrono Cross came out, and hopefully Alex will help me bring it to video life. But like Masato Kato's history, I mean, one of the first games he worked on was Ninja Gaiden alongside Yoshizawa, which Ninja Gaiden on NES is a pioneer in gaming narrative. And then you see what Yoshizawa and Kato would go on to do, with Yoshizawa doing Klonoa, which as we'll kind of just lightly touch on, does some things with what is at first seemingly just like a pithy, like, oh, it's a cute 2D platform, but like it's got some turns. And then, you know, Kato goes on and is essentially the lead story driver for Chrono Trigger, and then makes Chrono Cross, which then turns that on its ear. And even what he does with Radical Dreamers, which we can now experience now. It's just really neat and cool, and I love that kind of stuff. And it definitely seems like there's some critical divisiveness over those, but I love it.
Buy Klonoa.
Yeah, I'm going to.
Unless you don't want Klonoa to keep going, in which case, don't buy Klonoa and stop everyone else from buying Klonoa too.
All right, let's go to some listener mail. So HD Throw writes, I love Street Pass, but I agree that it's a poor fit with the Switch. Why doesn't Nintendo produce a much smaller and cheaper device you could carry slash wear that ties back to your Switch account? I feel they could make good money in a variety of ways while also driving up customer engagement for seemingly less effort than the Pokeball Plus. Am I underestimating the complexity of the tech? I'm assuming something as simple as an AirTag would be more than enough to replicate many of the 3DS features, and probably a ton more. It could also give a new lease on life to Amiibo. Am I foolish to think this might be something Nintendo was working on?
How did Street Pass work? Was it just, did it just use whatever the local connection was?
I think so. Because, like, I mean, it drains the battery so hard. Yeah,
that must be what it is. Because, yeah, I don't think that on a, I'm going to talk like I know anything. But I don't think that it would be impossible by any means for the Switch to do that.
I mean, I think that's why it's a lot of things that Nintendo does, especially when they do have features implemented in the systems. And, you know, there's, you look at a lot of what they did with the Wii U, and some of it's misguided, but there's usually like a cohesion to it. Like there's a, yeah, there is a goal with what they are doing. And, you know, the design of 3DS with Street Pass involved was about, you know, having it on you at all time, and having that like you passed by someone that also had a 3DS, and you could make that connection. And it really was about like bringing people together, being able to share their games, making it a more social experience, making it something you would check. With Switch, like there was definitely a more back to basics approach with especially how they designed the hardware. I mean, you look at over the course of Wii, 3DS, and Wii U, how complex and convoluted the menus for those systems would get, even the custom menus on 3DS. Wii U, how you could switch between, you know, the Miiverse display and the channels, and like just how you could navigate the eShop there, and how there's all this other external functions, TV, Nintendo TV. Mm-hmm. Just the concept of that like all this fluff. And what is the Switch? What was the Switch at launch? It was play your fucking games. Here's an eShop. That's it. That's the display. That's it. It is. There wasn't even, you didn't even have, you know, what I think like a couple streaming apps are on it. Netflix is still not on it. Netflix was on my friggin' 3DS. It's still not on my Switch.
Yeah, that is baffling.
Nintendo's focus changed, and clearly by how they're doing it, it was for the better. But it doesn't seem like they're as interested in making their systems that connective tissue that it was in the way that got us things like Street Pass and Miiverse and Nintendo TV. With some of those are catastrophic failures. TV was bad.
Miiverse was great.
TV was a few years too early. I think the concept of TV, if you apply the concept of TV to like streaming platforms and like more modern things as opposed to cable, TV is a function that I still wish was more readily available in that context.
I think second screens as you're watching things did not work the way people intended. Even Xbox went hard into that with smart glass.
I guess I more mean the element of like being able to see everything that's on.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that was a cool thing.
I love that. I love that so much.
And that's like the fact that I can't just turn on my TV and go, I want to watch fucking Miss Congeniality 2 and have it tell me exactly which of my 27 subscription services that's on.
I mean, I have the Google OS on my TV and it runs a little chunky, but I can do that.
Okay, well, fuck you, Roku TV.
That was actually part of the reason when because I got a new TV because my old one broke, and I was like, all right, I would like to do this feature. And I was able to do it on my phone through like the Google Play Store, where mm-hmm. I'd just be able to like look up a movie and it'd be like, oh, okay, like if I want to get it, I can rent it here, or if we subscribe to the streaming service there. The Google OS lets me be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, I guess my point is that's I feel like what Nintendo TV could have been.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a lot of the fluff of that, and also the idea of that as a second screen. I second screens just failed with TVs.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind. I feel like when like there were certain times, like I think it was like the Amazon app would pull up like all of the actors that are in.
Oh, yeah.
Amazon, whatever you're watching. X-ray.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, as somebody who frantically IMDBs while he watches things like that, that's a useful feature.
Yeah. And I feel like the only way in that second screens have worked with TVs is through your phone. Maybe there are people that use more tablets, but I remember there was like the 360 thing where they demoed smart glass, where it was like, you could see where people are on the map of Game of Thrones during the show. Which was like, oh, that seemed neat, but I don't think anybody interacted.
I feel like all that really does is exposes plot holes in Game of Thrones' incredible time travel mechanics. You're like, how did he get from this point to this point in a day?
Once I got past where the books left off, they were like, we can't do this anymore. But to go back to kind of like the ending question of this email, I don't think you're foolish to think that this might be something Nintendo's working on. I'd imagine the idea of what to do, like Street Pass on 3DS, like that was cool. How can we bring it back? I feel like Nintendo over the years has proven that they don't necessarily throw out ideas.
It was kind of a nice little advertising thing, because you'd open it up and you'd have a person walk up to you and they'd be like, I've been playing Donkey Kong Country.
Yep.
And you're like, oh, I like Donkey Kong Country. And then maybe you go buy Donkey Kong Country, which I guess is almost like now on your Switch, while you're playing, you'll constantly see a thing in the top left corner that says, which I do. But it'll tell you, you know, whoever is playing this game.
Oh, I need to turn that off because I do video capture for games, and
it will show up at the worst possible time. Yeah.
I forget what game I was capturing where I was downloading something and it said like, your download's complete. I'm like, damn it.
Yeah. I need to just always be downloading something a little weird so that it pops up in the corner of random reviews and they're like, what were you downloading?
Galgun.
Oh, well, I'd have to delete it off my system first so I could re-download it. But yeah, that'd work.
Or Xenoblade Chronicles 2. I
mean, that's arguably worse. Yeah.
But I dearly miss Street Pass. It was a cool concept. I think with how the Switch is, I also think an external, like an AirTag thing for it, I don't think would take off.
Yeah, and I don't think you I suppose you could do it. You could include it in the Nintendo Switch app on your phone.
I guess.
Put Street Pass on your phone.
I would not. I mean, if it is something like that, then I wouldn't trust Nintendo to do it in a way that wouldn't be obtuse.
Yeah.
Which is disappointing because the cool thing about Street Pass was that like it just kind of worked. I passed somebody while street passing them in a car. And it's really cool. And I think it was I think if memory serves me correctly, I think it was like an NWR reader who like then like posted on like Twitter or the forums or something that was like, yeah, I just passed Neil Ronahan. What the hell happened? And like I replied, I was like, today? I was like, I like drove to work. And he's like, oh yeah, I live here. And I'm like, that's near when were you driving? And then we realized that we drove past each other.
That's crazy. Best place for Street Pass is Disney World. I finished a lot of puzzles at Disney World.
I mean, I till the end of my life, I will never forget street passing at E3. I think I probably had E3s during peak 3DS time where I played Street Pass on 3DS on the show floor more than like eight times as more as any games that I ever played. Just clearing out like dozens of people, and it would just immediately fill up and you just see like seas of people all doing the same thing. Anyway, I think the only thing we really have to talk about is we need to bring back the Star Wars part of this. I guess we never really talked that much about Obi-Wan, but that might...
No, we didn't. I liked it.
Yeah, no, it was fine.
It was bad. I hated it.
Oh, really? No. Really?
I like the way I said it. It was like there are moments that I liked, but the contrivances that were used to get to that moment felt like it cheapened the end product.
That's definitely that show. Like, it's the kind of thing where I don't even think I disagree with that take. But I enjoyed it, like, for what it was. Like, there's things about it that were really clumsy, but the good outweighed the bad.
This might be a controversial opinion, but I think we need to accept that if we're going to have Darth Vader in a lightsaber fight, trying to do, like, prequel-style lightsaber fights, you gotta give him like a CG helmet or something so that the poor actor inside can see what they're doing. Because every fight scene with Darth Vader, it was so like he would get to position before the other actor was even there.
Yeah. Oh, that's true to form to the original series.
But you can just always tell that it's like that poor guy can't see shit and he is trying his best.
He's hitting his marks.
They brought Hayden back for this and all he's doing is putting a robot suit.
No, I liked it. I thought it was great.
Yeah,
I watched it concurrently with season 4 of Stranger Things, and so I think that's the reason why. It's like Stranger Things season 4 is real good.
I'm gonna hurt you a little bit, but
yeah,
I've tried to watch Stranger Things twice, and I hated it both times.
I remain in the middle, and that I enjoyed the first season, and then just stopped watching it in the middle of the second season because I didn't want to.
Two and three are bad.
It was not good enough to outweigh the fact that it's just like a bunch of children getting terrorized and I just had a kid and like, I was like, this kind of isn't as enjoyable as it was before. Yeah.
That's fair. I don't have children.
I've like talked to some friends and like heard a little bit about what happened in the final season. And like some of the stuff seems metal as all hell, but I'm also like, oh, if my concerns about children getting terrorized, then maybe this is not the show for me.
Oh yeah.
I mean, if it makes you feel better, they're all like 20 now.
Yeah. Now,
so
like,
it's not really children anymore.
Dustin has a family of four himself. Like,
yeah.
I mean, like, people involved in Stranger Things, like, the actor's great. Yeah, I mean, Stranger Things, I hold real no ill will towards, other than the fact that, like, I don't think I'm gonna watch it anytime soon.
I dislike the period of filmmaking that is emulating. Like, I don't like the
Spielberg in the 80s.
Stephen King. 80s,
like, I think E.T. is an actively horrible movie.
Okay. You know, this explains a lot. This explains a lot.
So Stranger Things does not appeal to me.
Spielberg's my jam. Like, I think
other stuff that's, it's just like Spielberg, like, it's that, like, these five small children have found something incredible, yeah, and their bedroom is really smoky for some reason.
Yeah,
and,
like, I love that stuff.
It's that, oh, it's that vibe that I just can't.
Super 8 is the best J.J. Abrams movie.
I mean, I do really like the Star Trek 2009, so, but Super 8, Super 8's not bad. Super 8's a real good Spielberg movie. Like,
it is.
Yeah, it does a good, it emulates a thing very well.
Yeah, and Coach is in it, so I can't really hate anything with Coach in it.
Yeah, this has been Star Wars talk.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Sorry.
Well, the
guys.
One thing about it is, what did kind of spur this was talking about the Taika Waititi quote that he had making the new Thor movie that has Natalie Portman in it, and now Taika Waititi is lined up after this to make a Star Wars movie. He revealed in an interview that he just liked talking to Natalie Portman, and Natalie was like, "What are you doing after this?" He's like, "I'm going to do a Star Wars thing. Have you ever done a Star Wars thing?" And she's just like, "Yes." And he just forgot those. Like, she was the lead actress in a trilogy. I don't know exactly when this conversation happened, but, like, presumably they had been working together for a while.
Yeah.
At some point, you'd be like, "What else was Natalie Portman in, huh?"
Yeah. Well, and it's
Black Swan.
She was in two previous Thor movies.
Yeah.
There is a corner of the internet that is so upset with him for it, and I just think it's funny.
Funny. Like,
brain fart. It's okay. Laugh about it. I don't think it's because he hates Star Wars or you personally. He might hate you personally, depending on who you are. But
I do. Like, a growing theory that I have now is, at first I thought it was Rian Johnson defending against the dark arts, the Star Wars filmmaking process, but I think it was George Lucas. Like, he sold it to Disney and was like, "Yeah, you're fucked now." Because if you think about everything that's happened with Star Wars movies, like, even the ones that we consider as good had something bad happen to them. Like, Rogue One, a movie that, I mean, there's definitely, I feel like with all of the recent rash of Star Wars movies, there are people, some people just hate all of them, and everybody has there's like, I imagine there are people out there who hate Rogue One. But that seems to be the one
100% are. Yeah,
that seems to be the one that overall, you know, more neutral than most. And even that, like the director got kicked off, it was just quiet. And then Solo, mm-hmm, the director got kicked off and it was loud. And then Josh Trank was supposed to do a Boba Fett movie. And then, like, I don't even know what happened. It was like he had dogs shit everywhere. Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
Colin Trevorrow made a Jurassic World movie after making an indie movie. And they were like, "We're going to give you the world, son." And then they're like, "Actually, no. We saw Book of Henry."
Then he made another indie movie.
Yeah.
That apparently sucked.
I forget what else he did, and now he's back doing Jurassic stuff again. Apparently that new movie was bad. That's what I've heard. And who else got, Game of Thrones guys were gonna do Star Wars, mm-hmm, things. They cooked their own goose, I guess.
Did you say Patty Jenkins?
Yeah, yeah, Patty Jenkins no, is
she's
probably
still technically has
she's
not,
not
been
well I mean out. So Rian Johnson is still making more ones.
Yeah.
I believe I have more confidence that Patty Jenkins is making a Star Wars movie than Rian Johnson is making a Star Wars
I agree with that. They have announced a title of a movie. But, like, Whiplash in that, like, because I think that was like weeks before Wonder Woman 1984 came out, that I was like, "Yo, man, like, Patty Jenkins making that sounds great. Like, the first Wonder Woman was good. She's done good stuff. Like, 84 looks sick. Got Pedro Pascal, he's Max Lord, it's gonna be awesome." And like, I was talking about the Taika Waititi quote and my theory on the Star Wars curse to a friend, and they had not seen Wonder Woman 1984, and I explained the plot of that movie to them, and they're like, "What? No, that is not the
movie." Did you highlight the rape scenes in particular?
That is what I led with, and I was like, "Yeah, like she was going to make a Star Wars movie, and then she released a Wonder Woman movie in which Wonder Woman raped a man."
You can listen to this podcast to hear a reaction to that. Matt Zawadniak reacting to the ghost rape in Wonder Woman in 1984 is at the end of the Metroid 2 Samus Returns Game Club episode. It's after the outro.
I forgot that we had the actual reaction to him that. Like, I watch the movie, like, especially when it goes to the end, and sorry, spoilers for a terrible movie.
I still haven't seen the end, but go for it. I didn't make it.
No, so like the last scene is like Diana like walking through a field, and she like, or like it's like a square or a park or something, and like sees the dude that Chris Pine had like possessed, and like smiles, and then it's like credits.
God, that's creepy.
It's so weird.
Yeah,
so creepy.
Like they like smile at each other, like, and like, yes, I'm like
a victim.
And like,
it's supposed
like,
to be sweet, but yeah, it's
I mean, it's the kind
atrocious.
Of thing, like, multiple people approved that. People filmed it. Someone wrote it. Right. Was like, this is fine.
And we are far from the only people going, wait, isn't that rape? Like, I mean, that's like, it is a like,
it's a different country. We are 40 years after Revenge of the Nerds tried to be like, rape's fine.
I assume that the talks went after that came out and they delayed Rogue Squadron, they were like, all right. They're like, can you just double check the Rogue Squadron script real quick to make sure there's absolutely no rape?
And then you find out it's like, actually, this guy became possessed by Biggs Darklighter, and then he did this, and
it's 100% ghost rape. That is the plot.
Anyway, Star Wars. But now I've accepted the fate as of this recording. I'm probably going to see Thor Love and Thunder day after this recording, because we're recording it before the movie's even out in America. But I did like glance at just like some of the headlines of the reviews. It seems like it's more divisive than Ragnarok was. I'm worried.
Ragnarok already divisive?
I think there was division of Ragnarok, but I think this one. With Ragnarok, you had people like, I definitely fall into the category of Ragnarok's like my favorite MCU movie. There are a number of people who view Ragnarok as incredible. There are definitely people like John. I know you're not as hot on it.
Yeah.
But this one, there don't seem to be a lot of people that are like, this is incredible. Everybody's just kind of like, nah.
Ragnarok has a critic rating on Rotten Tomatoes of 93%.
Yeah. I think. Unheard of that Love and Thunder has like a 73.
Ooh, I don't know. That might actually be the right score for me. I don't know if that works with movies or not.
Well, that's actually, I did like, because I mean, this led me down the rabbit hole of people being mad at Taika Waititi about the Natalie Portman quote, and also just being mad at him for existing, it seems. And I think we are reaching the point where, unfortunately, I think Taika is a very funny, smart, creative mind. What We Do in the Shadows, all-time great, like unimpeachably incredible. He's going to have to fall, because no Star Wars movie can be made without a hitch.
I think he's already in mid-hitch. Like his Star Wars movie has not moved in a long time.
Well, I mean, because like, he was making it with Thor. A stick.
Yeah, but it was, I don't know, man.
Well, no, they kind of, I believe they re-upped saying that was the next one being made. And it was basically like he was going to make it after Thor.
But wasn't that like, didn't they say that like a long time ago?
I mean, I guess let's see if that movie starts to go into production in the next year.
Yeah.
Look, John, we have a logo, okay?
Yeah.
Do we?
Yeah.
No, I don't think we
Taika
do.
Taika Waititi did it like, I think it's something that he made, actually.
He just made it in Procreate. Good.
It's like this old, like, I guess, like, I'm not sure if it's like 70s, like really.
Yeah,
pulpy
I know
looking.
The one you're talking about.
Yeah. It's just the Star Wars logo, but
I am so excited for stylized. People to hate his Star Wars movie because it is not going to be a Rogue One Kenobi Star Wars movie.
It is.
It's going to be like, weird.
I really want to see it. I hope it actually does happen. Okay, yeah, I have seen that logo. It is the kind of thing that, like, it's almost like with Love and Thunder, where seeing that people are kind of like, I don't know about it, I'm almost more excited to see it. Because, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love Ragnarok and everything, but like, oh, did he go too weird? I want to see him go too weird.
Yeah, well, I think my favorite of the newer Star Wars movies has been Solo. So I'm willing to do the not totally traditional Star Wars movies. So
yeah.
Do your worst, Taika.
Yeah.
I'm totally down for it. It's just like separate it from the rest of the universe.
I think I did see some quote from him probably from like last month that was something along the lines that he's like, I'm not gonna make a movie about like Chewbacca's uncle.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, I have to make something new. And and we'll see how much creative freedom he actually gets. I don't know if I'm going to say blindly in Taika I trust until I see it. Maybe I'll say it after Love and Thunder if I dig it. But I definitely, his Star Wars movie will be fascinating, whatever it is, even if it sucks.
Yep.
And that's all I want. That's what I have the distinct memory. I was trapped in Green Bay, Wisconsin when the news of Disney buying Lucasfilm was. It happened during Hurricane Sandy. When that hit New Jersey, that's why I was trapped in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I remember talking to my dad as we movie theater hopped because we had nothing to do because there was no football on because we were trapped in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I was just like, you know what? Even like the hype for a new Star Wars movie is going to be fun, even if they suck. And I almost ate those words, but the Taika Star Wars movie, if it actually happens, will be fun, even if it sucks.
Yeah.
Well, even when a Star Wars movie sucks, it's interesting to talk about. So I'm there either way.
And the bar is so delightfully low.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So delightfully low.
All right. I think that's going to do it for this episode of Connectivity. You can send us some email at connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You can hit us up on Twitter at @ConnectivityNWR. John or Alex, well, I guess John, Xenoblade content, it's coming. Go check his Xenoblade content out.
I mean, it should already be. If it's not out, then something went very wrong with YouTube scheduler.
And Alex is going to be playing Klonoa for y'all. You should buy Klonoa or read his review.
Yeah, I'll be doing that, and then I'll probably have like a birthday weekend thing going on this weekend, and then I'll work on the Chrono Cross.
And you're all invited.
Yeah, yay. Everybody, come on over, play Klonoa with me. Yay. There is a second player. It doesn't work properly, or not. It doesn't. It's not that it doesn't work properly. It just sucks. Yeah.
All right, that's an episode. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.